Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. As Americans, we all learn some foundational dates. 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. 1776, the Declaration of Independence, all the way to 1969 and the landing on the moon. We learn these dates because we believe the events made us who we are today. Now, a group of historians and journalists want to add a new foundational date to that list, 1619. It's the year enslaved Africans were brought to North America and sold into slavery. And its 400th anniversary is being reexamined in a new series of articles and essays in the New York Times. Discussing the project with us today is Khalil Gibran Muhammad. He joins us from WGBO in New Jersey. He's a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he wrote an essay for the New York Times Magazine's 1619 Project about the history of the sugar industry and the slave trade. Khalil Muhammad, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
With us in the studio is Kelly Carter Jackson. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley College and author of Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And you, have you heard of 1619? What role do you think slavery played in our founding and growth as a country? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Kelly Carter Jackson, what was your first reaction to hearing of the 1619 Project?
Oh, I was super excited about it. As a historian, I'm always trying to bring attention to not just 1619, but the story of slavery in general and the story of the lived experiences of Black Americans. And so I feel like it gives a lot of volume to the work that I'm doing, and the fact that people are so excited about it, the fact that I've yet to get a copy because it's pretty much sold out everywhere. I think it's exciting for me to see that people are taking these conversations seriously and that they're wanting to talk more about them and not just talk about them at a surface level, but really get to the depth of these issues and look at the legacy of slavery and the ramifications, and not just see it as something that happened so long ago, but something that is so present with us right now.
Khalil Muhammad, what was your reaction when you got the call to actually write an essay for this project?
A little bit of shock, because although I am a historian, unlike Professor Carter Jackson, I'm not a slavery historian. But I think part of the conceit of this entire issue is a very conscious and intentional way of answering the so what question that often academic historians shy away from, and that is to make visible and clear how the legacy of slavery still shapes America today. And so I took up the challenge and wrote about really the earliest form of slavery in the Americas, and that is the cultivation of sugar.
I want to come back in a little more detail to your essay in a little bit, but I want to pick up, Kelly, you talked about not even being able to get a hard copy, and the New York Times printed hundreds of thousands of extra copies, and you still can't get one.
Yeah.
So there is clearly a tremendous appetite for this moment and for this recognition, for this discussion. Mm-hmm. Why?
I think there are a lot of reasons as to why. I think that Americans in particular are obsessed with their identity. I think that there is, and we've seen this in the past maybe 10, 20 years, these push for DNA kits and this idea to sort of know who you are, know who you're related to, know your past. I think that we've always been fascinated with the past because the past is a roadmap, not just to our present, but to our future. And so for me, it's always exciting to see people that want to engage with the past and want to know more about what made this country possible and what made this country profitable, but also what aspects of our history are really problematic and really troubling, and how do we reckon with that? I hope more Americans are wanting to do the hard work of understanding American history.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Have you read the 1619 Project, the early essays? What do you think of the project, and how important do you think that date is to the essence of who we are as the United States of America? Let's take a call. Sarah from Cambridge, go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much. 1619 Project is just incredible, so thank you all for all your efforts in putting this together. I did a PhD on African studies in Senegal particularly, and I wanted to ask both of the speakers today whether or not they thought it would be helpful in how we talk about slavery and the origins of slavery here in the United States within the context of how blacks sold blacks, particularly West Africa, there's about hierarchy and power. And I wonder if framing it that way would be helpful in just getting to racial reconciliation between whites and blacks, understanding that it was very much about commerce and that this notion of what is white and what is black is obviously a social construct that we put on it to make it feel like it was a black thing. But ultimately, it was really about commerce and about hierarchy and about power.
Sarah, thanks for that call. Khalil, I'll turn to you because commerce is core to your essay on the sugar industry. What's your answer to Sarah's question?
Well, I think it's a good reminder of the complexities that underlie this half millennia of history. There have been ongoing debates that we've seen play out in social media and in some conservative responses to the 1619 Project, which echo some of what the caller just mentioned, and that is that that Africans sold their own into slavery, and so why aren't we talking about that? Or that Muslims, Arab traders, for example, were some of the earliest to use sugar plantations in the Mediterranean region. And what worries me is not that our history is even more complicated with regard to the relationship of commerce and industry, of the actual profiting from the coerced labor of others, but that these tend to be gotcha games in an effort to diffuse the basic narrative of this project, which is what do we need to know to understand the United States of America better? And in that sense, the project hits the nail on the head for the most part. We certainly expect our classrooms to be responsible for world history, for global history, to tell the backstory for how those ships left Portugal and Spain in the first place on their way to West African and Central African countries. So it's not to say that it's one or the other. It is most certainly both. But the context in which we're having a conversation about both often is framed in a polemics of racism in America is not so bad after all.
Kelly, you nodded so many times that I was going to ask another question, but let me come to you first.
Sure. I get this question all the time, and I think I have to tell my students a lot. It's not just about who participated, because when you think of the institution of slavery, everyone participated. Everyone's hands are dirty. Everyone is complicit. Everyone has direct and indirect a role to play within the slave trade. I think a better question to answer or ask is who benefited the most? Who profited the most? Who made the most out of this institution? Who prolonged this institution the most? And I think that when you ask those particular questions, all fingers don't necessarily point back to black Africans. They point back to these European colonial powers and how they constructed their own societies, how they become world leaders, industrial powers, is because of the systems that they profited from. So I think that's really important. Participation is key, but everyone plays a role. It's who's perpetuating the role. That, to me, is most important.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. If you want to join the conversation, I'm torn. There are like three different directions I want to go with this conversation all at once. I think, Khalil, one of the things that really struck me about your sugar essay was the idea that, in fact, sugar itself, the way it exists in our country, couldn't have without slavery, if I'm not overstating it. Am I overstating it? And can you talk a bit more about that?
Not at all. I mean, so there's history and then there's what might have happened. So the what might have happened part of this is that in other parts of the world, sugar might have been cultivated at a level that would have made it a cheap commodity for world export, in which case some other part of the globe would have been responsible. But as it happened, it was precisely Christopher Columbus in the late 15th century that brought sugar, or cane more particularly, to South America and Central America. And as such, sugar proliferated. Now, it both proliferated because the environment made that possible. Semi-tropical to tropical environment is required for the most intense intense or highest content of sucrose in the plant itself, but also because of the ability to cultivate it with enslaved labor. Enslaved labor was already happening, again, as I suggested or said, in the Mediterranean region, but on a scale in combination with a land that was stolen and expropriated by indigenous people, and then this massive trade in human bodies of enslaved Africans all made sugar essentially a very cheap commodity that would build up the literal financial wealth of the North American colonies owned by Britain and made possible Wall Street as a central financial capital by the early 18th century.
Let's take another call. We've got Jan from Bellingham on the line. Jan, go ahead. Jan, do we have you? Okay, I think we lost Jan, but Jan was going to talk about the fact that the implications of 1619 are felt all the way through to today. And I wanted to get to that because part of the really intense pushback and criticism of this project seems to be a reaction to an argument that 1619 is so meaningful that, in fact, it's the actual founding date of the country. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who used to teach history at West Georgia College, which is now West Georgia University, has been really critical of the project. He argued on Fox that thousands of white Americans died in the Civil War for the cause of ending slavery and that saying slavery is the defining force of American history is, quote, propaganda and a lie. He is far from the only person criticizing the 1619 project. Kelly, do you think, I'm just going to be honest, did positing the 1619, that it should essentially replace 1776 as sort of the founding moment of our country, push people, especially white people, too far and weaken the message? Or was it absolutely necessary to put that stake in the ground?
I think it's absolutely necessary to put that stake in the ground. I think that there has been a lot of willful amnesia, selective amnesia, in terms of how people want to remember America. And people want to see America as all good and all great and a land of opportunity. And part of that story can still be true, but I think we also have to acknowledge the ugly side of America and the fact that racism in this country has been a cancer that we have been sort of refusing to treat and refusing to deal with. And I think, you know, if we were to look at racism as a cancer, we can't say, oh, no, don't talk about cancer. That's too negative. You've got such a great smile. You know, like, you know, you would want to focus.
When you put it that way.
But you would want to focus on how do we attack this cancer? What is my family history? What is my chances of passing this to the next generation? How can I make sure that this cancer is cured and not repeated? And I think that's what historians, you know, their role is to sort of remind people of the past and show them a useful present and a useful and a possible future forward. And so it's really important that we talk about 1619 as the founding, not just of the United States, but of North America in general. I think it's a good framework for how we understand how countries and powers are formed.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We got Jan back. And so Jan from Bellingham, I don't know if you were able to hear that, but I asked the question about, you know, how important is it to root 1619 as the real founding of America. Did I get your question right, or was there anything else you wanted to ask?
Well, what I was saying is that I think 1619 really is such an important date because even though many things happened between then and 1776, if you look at the long-term impact it had in our society, and you, I mean, to me, Reconstruction is a perfect example of sort of the fallout of what happened in 1619. It could have gone one way, but because by then we had established these mental images of people who were slaves and what white people would lose if those people gained power, Reconstruction turned out to, you know, lead to Jim Crow. Now we have mass incarceration. And I think that I'm a white person. I think most white people just don't see the history, and I think you got to start from the beginning.
Jan, thanks so much for that. And that is central to Khalil's work. So, Khalil, let me turn to you and invite you to respond.
Well, I want to say that history is not passive in this. I mean, the provocation that 1619 should be the origin story and the origin date for the United States is just that. It's a provocation. If we were all historically literate, if our classrooms from K to 12 were teaching history in the way that academic historians have been writing about for the past 50 years, then this would be a minor note. It's a major note precisely because the political project of distorting the American past has been, since mostly the beginning, since the actual constitutional conventional debates, where they actually buried the debates about slavery for the purposes of getting ratification itself.
You mean sort of buried them ongoing, in the record? What do you mean by buried, just for our listeners?
Well, the constitutional debates were sealed. They weren't revealed until half a century later by James Madison. So the fact is we've been playing political footsie with the true history of our country precisely because it was rooted in the basic treatment of 20% of the population that fundamentally contradicted the very basis upon which the nation was founded. So this project invites us to have an educated conversation about the nature of this country and the future of this country based on a more honest, accurate, and truthful telling of that history. Some people will start at zero. Other people will start with a very sophisticated understanding. But even those that start with a sophisticated understanding, like Newt Gingrich, will still attempt to distort what this project actually does in favor of a political agenda that is about saying America can do no wrong. It is simply a God-divined country that is exceptional and unlike any other place on earth.
All right, the lines are full, so let's take some calls. Rob from Cambridge, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a first-generation American, and my family on both sides didn't come here voluntarily. And what I'm trying to figure out is, how do people who came here way after slavery, or let's say somebody who just became, was just admitted to the country, how do they think about slavery?
How do they or how should they, Rob? I want to understand your question.
Well, I'm saying I'm not sure what oughts and shoulds are, but how could they think about slavery?
Okay. There we go. And I'm going to add one more call in, and then I'm going to invite Kelly to answer those questions. Pat from Watertown, please go ahead.
Hi, how are you? This might speak to the last question. The article that I've read from the 1619 Project, and thank you to everybody for all your work, that most struck me was Wesley Morris's article about minstrelsy as the beginning of American entertainment. And I think the difference between American slavery and other slaveries historically is during slavery, you know, I think it starts with minstrelsy, but I might be wrong. In 1830, you have white Irish people in New York starting to create this image, which becomes the dominant image of popular culture as African Americans, as not just slaves, but as subhuman.
Thanks for that, Pat. All right. So I wanted to get a couple calls. I almost wish I'd sort of taken this separately because I want to make sure we do justice to both of them. So first, Kelly, Rob says if you came to this country, like his family did, involuntarily or significantly later, mm-hmm. how could one think about slavery? Let me give you that question.
Sure. I think, you know, I get a lot of these questions from my students as well in terms of, well, I don't see the role that I play in this, or I'm not sure how I'm connected to this, or my grandparents didn't own slaves, or great-great-grandparents didn't own slaves. And that's not necessarily relevant. I think we need to think about the system itself and how power works and how race works in particular in America. And I think that, you know, it's very easy to see how slavery was wrong and evil and problematic, how segregation was wrong. But we don't often look at the corollary aspect of that is, how did racism benefit people? How did segregation benefit people? How did white Americans get advantaged through their whiteness? Not just the degradation of blackness, but the benefits and privileges of whiteness. And
for every disadvantage, there was an advantage.
There certainly was an advantage. And I think that there's an unwillingness as well to sort of look at how white people benefit. And I think there's even controversy of even how we use the phrase privilege. It's not about wealth, but it's about how you are able to move through society, how you're able to have access to certain things simply because of the color of your skin. And so I think we have to look at it twofold. We have to look at how does racism work systemically, but also how is it benefiting you purely because you are a white person? If you come to this country country and you are of African descent, you're going to have a completely different experience than someone who comes to this country who is of European descent. And those differences need to be talked about and fleshed out.
Okay, and Khalil, to Pat's question, which I'm kind of struggling to summarize, so I'm going to hope I don't need to, and that you're going to be able to jump
oh,
right
remember.
In. Great. Please,
yeah,
go
yeah,
ahead.
No, first of all, you know, I haven't heard enough about Wesley Morris's great essay, so I want to invite your listeners to read it, because it hasn't gotten the attention it deserved. In some ways, it is the third leg of this three-pronged foundation that the project focuses on, and that is that if you just take one gigantic step back, and this is a way of pulling together those two questions to the first-generation European immigrant, you can't understand America's wealth, its political systems, and its culture without understanding the presence of those enslaved Africans, period. And therefore, what Wesley Morris reminds us is that Irish immigrants themselves found their American home through the appropriation of the black experience. And all immigrants to this day are still running through a prism of blackness that helps to explain the 1965 Immigration Act, which was a consequence of the civil rights movement, which helps to explain a wealthy nation that has the capacity to welcome newcomers, which helps to explain birthright citizenship, which grows out of the end of the Civil War in the 14th Amendment. Immigrants today owe it to themselves to understand the history of the country, which cannot be understood without understanding the presence of black people and the period of slavery to Jim Crow to our present.
Kelly, you teach. Will this project inform your future curriculum?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are so many essays that I was like, oh, I could put this on my syllabus. I could put this on my syllabus, you know? And there's, I think, a lot of, you know, op-eds that have come out of this as well, opinion pieces, both in favor and against, that I think are useful in the classroom to generate these discussions. And I think the 1619 Project is just going to be a treasure trove for a long time to come.
And Khalil, obviously you wrote one of the essays, but will you teach other parts of it in your curriculum as well?
It's on the syllabus already.
Excellent.
it makes my job so much easier, let me tell you, definitely.
The whole thing, or are there specific pieces of it?
Oh, the whole thing. I mean, it's a book. As you well know, students don't read enough these days.
I was a professor, and I do know.
Yes. And so having essays that were constrained by word count, which certainly was true in my case, and really helped to write with clarity and efficiency is a wonderful thing. And I think lots of people will be assigning the 1619 Project to their students.
Mm-hmm. Khalil Gibran Muhammad is a professor of history, race, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Kelly Carter Jackson is an assistant professor in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. I really appreciate you being here. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.